Okay, good afternoon. Or morning? Good morning, yes. This mic does. Okay, so that is. Okay, we're going to do some review for the midterm that's on Thursday. So this is going to be, I don't have anything particular to go over, so I'll take what things, questions you have. I'll just take questions and we'll write them down and sort them and go through them. Okay.
So there was, I guess, a few questions on the past examples of public versus stalling for when the ALU is busy, it would be like a signal 1 if it's busy, 0 if it's not. So could we go over those few questions?
Okay.
Then when would you bubble, when would you stall, when would you keep the same instruction?
Okay, so stalling for slow execution units. So we talked about multi-cycle execution units, so there's past questions about what does the pipeline do if you're waiting for one of those. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Can we go over how to identify when you have to forward?
Okay, identifying when you need to forward. Okay.
Like in the quiz where it had the which address was in the same block in the same set.
Okay. Tag index offset and same set block, etc. Okay. Okay. Precise exceptions and reorder buffers. Okay. Other. Yeah.
Let's talk about blocking accesses for
for
loops.
DRAM versus SRAM?
Yeah, but then
Just the difference in speed or like the technology?
Yeah.
Okay, so just DRAM versus SRAM. Speed, physical difference. Okay. Yeah.
Direct map versus associative
map. Direct map versus associative. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Data flow model, okay. Yeah.
There was a good question that asked about processors are getting faster and memory is also getting faster, but which ones processors get faster than memory does? So can you talk about why that's the case, and also the hierarchy of which technology gets better faster, which technology stays slower faster?
Memory, okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Serial
cache accesses?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other topics? Or should I just start to triage these? Yeah.
Write back
versus write through. Okay. Okay, so let's start to sort these. So we have pipelining questions, which are this. Do we have any others? No. We have cache questions. I'll take cache performance separately. And out of order, cache and memory. Okay.
Okay, so this is my sorting of these, so we'll go through approximately in order. So start with stalling for slow execution units. So we've often talked about, what if we have an execution unit, which we haven't talked about execution units in this way, but conceptually, when you have something which takes multiple cycles to do a computation and isn't pipelined, you have some funny, let me look at the right screen, let me draw in black. So you have some funny ALU here. You take in two results, get an output that you're using in your pipeline. So this is the decode execute. This is execute memory. And you get out a signal which says done. And the idea here is that sometimes that if you have an add, you'll be able to do the normal thing. But maybe your divisions are a lot slower. So maybe for division, instead of that, you have like fetch, decode, execute, 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 memory, write back. And the way this might work in the hardware is that you have this done signal out of your ALU, which when you're doing that division is going to be 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Saying, are we done with this big long division yet? So the question is, how do you implement this procedure in our pipeline where we need to have a stall here while we're waiting for the division to finish? This is something you do in a normal pipeline. You happen to need to have multiple cycles of execute for an instruction. So you have irregular times. Yeah.
You need to feed in four knobs, right?
So the question is, what's going to happen with the rest of the pipeline? So while we're doing our division, so we have division, fetch, decode, execute, 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 memory, write back. Then we have some normal next instruction. I'll say it's an add. So it's going to do fetch, decode, 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 decode.
So don't decode just the same?
Yeah. Because you can't advance this instruction to execute. This add, it's waiting over here. And I unwisely drew against the side of the page. But the add is waiting on input here. And there's some instruction that came before the division. So let's say subtract, which started earlier, which is just going to continue down the pipeline as usual, because it can't. We could stall it, but there's no reason to. So we're just going to let it continue down the pipeline. So that means at this point in time, there needs to be something in the memory stage. And what we're going to add is a knob. So we're going to need to bubble. So our pipeline signal, so out of here, while we're waiting, we're going to want a knob. And in here, waiting. We want to keep the add waiting. So our pipeline signals are going to be something like, so we have fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, and we're going to need to stall, because we need to stall here to, this is keep the division running. We need to stall here to keep the add waiting, and stall here to don't fetch after whatever's after the add, let's say an XOR. So those need to stall because we don't want to lose an instruction. If we didn't stall there, we'd get rid of an instruction from our pipeline, and that's bad if we're supposed to execute that instruction. So if we didn't stall before decode execute, or between fetch and decode, we'd lose this XOR instruction. Just forget about it. Presumably. So this XOR is stalled in fetch because it's waiting. Yeah.
So why don't you bubble instead? Because wouldn't bubble also save the instruction?
So when do we bubble? We bubble when we need to fill a slot hole. So bubbling here would not be helpful because we'd forget about bubbling. If we bubbled here, we'd forget about the add.
Oh, okay.
If we bubbled here, we'd forget about the division. We would start passing different things into the ALU, and we'd probably get confused. And we'd also get confused about where do we write the results of this division. So we're stalling. This is our pipeline. So this is fetch, decode, execute, memory writebacks. This is the, this is our pipeline registers here. I'll just draw, we have one here and one here. And this is our XF, this is FD, and so on. Yeah. So you're asking, what's between E and M? So we're working on our division. So our pipeline diagram is that we're stalling in the division. We're doing execute over and over. And I should make this actually be clear. So we're keeping executing over and over again. So if we stall here, what is that going to do? So that's not going to pass our execute on, which is good. So it makes sense from that perspective, but we have to consider what's going to happen with what's actually in this register when we start during, let's say, this cycle here. What's in the E to M register? And what's in there is the subtract, because the subtract is running in memory. Therefore, it must be what's being currently output by the E to M register. And during the next cycle, we don't want the subtract to run again in memory. So if we bubbled here, we'd have this situation where we would run memory we duplicate the subtract instruction and be running two copies of it. You'd run one copy in write back and one copy in memory. So we don't want to do that. So we're going to want to actually bubble from execute to memory. So we're keeping the division instruction, but we want to have a knob after it because we don't have anything else to put there. We don't want to keep the subtract instruction, and we don't want the division instruction to be advanced. If we do either of those things, we'll duplicate an instruction in our pipeline. And we also want memory to execute to advance normally because we want the subtract instruction to keep going, and after that there's going to be no ops in the pipeline, and we don't care if they advance to write back. Yes?
I think I'm missing some sort of logic with the bubble. Could you go over that one more time?
So during this, so this is when we're starting stalling. During this step, we want the subtract to advance from memory to write back. We want the division to stay and execute. So we've accounted for, so we know that this is going to be subtract. So we've accounted for what's going to go into write back. We know that this is going to be the division. And this is going to be our add, and this is going to be our XOR. So we don't know we don't have anything to account for to put in memory. But something needs to be there, and it better not be any of the things we put elsewhere.
So if we were to stall, it would basically redo instructional.
So if we were to stall, we'd be saying that if we were to stall, that would be putting this the subtract instruction there. But we already have a place for it, and it's not there. So if we were to stall, that would be saying the subtract instruction stays in memory and goes to write back, which would be bad. That would mean we'd have two subtracts all of a sudden, and we produce the wrong result. If we were to make it normal, we'd be saying the division goes to memory and stays in execute. And that's not also not something we want to do. Yes?
So as a general rule, you stall when you are waiting to enter a register and you for something to finish to go right there, and then you bubble when you're waiting on yourself to finish to move forward. I don't know if that was clear enough.
So yes, so the general rule is you stall when you want to keep the same thing where it is, and you bubble when you're staying in the same place, but the next thing needs to do nothing. I'm sorry that my pictures are very messy. Okay, so our next topic was identifying when you need to forward. Hopefully this is clear enough to use. So identifying when you need to forward. So generally you're gonna look for identifying when you need to forward. Yeah, sorry. Yes, I will post all these pictures. It might take a little bit of time, but I will do that. Okay, so let's go through an example. So identifying when you need to forward. So let's say we have some sequence of instructions, I need to make there be a good special case. Nop, and something like this. So the first step when identifying what we need to forward is that we have to find dependencies. We have to know when do these instructions depend on each other. And the way we look for that is we say, are we writing a value and then reading it? So we look at, say, we're writing RCX here, RBX here. We look for what reads this value we're writing. And we see that the subtract reads the value. It also overwrites RBX, so we don't need to look any further. And then we can look at this subtract writes RBX, and we can see, is that read later? And it is. See that it's read by there, and it's also read by this other subtract. So our first step is to look for dependencies, these direct uses of a value that's written by another instruction. So these are cases where we might need to forward. So the question is, which of these do we actually need to forward for? And the way to figure that out is to look at what's happening in our pipeline. So we say that this add is going to go fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back, subtract, similarly. And to do this, we also need to know if there's going to be any stalling. So what happens in this case, there's no stalling, because we can satisfy all our dependencies without stalling, which we will see when we try to figure out forwarding. If you try to figure out forwarding and it turns out you need to forward backwards in time, you need to add stalling. So we just figure out where all these
constructions end up. Memory fetch code and fetch, and that goes off the page. We'll see if that's a problem. Okay, so WMED. Okay, so then we look at these individual cases and figure out where does it work without forwarding. So if it works without forwarding, then we'd have the value be available here, and we need to be reading it, and we read it into code. So naturally, we're going to write the value in write back and read it into code. And for this orange dependency here, that doesn't work. Right? We're writing it, it's going to be written here, and it's going to be need to be read around here. That doesn't work. That's impossible, so we must need forwarding. So then we have to say, how are we forwarding? And to forward for this, the earliest we can forward is going to be execute, from the end of execute. So from here, so that's the earliest we can forward. And the latest we can get our value is before execute here. If we don't have the value by then, we have a problem, because we actually need the result in execute. So our forwarding path is going to be probably from the end of execute to the end of decode. Yeah?
So you can forward to the same stage that you're in, the same cycle that you're in, right?
So you can forward to the same cycle. We never forward back in time. We never forward forward in time. It has to happen in one cycle. But we just have these restrictions on how far ahead we can forward. Yes?
Just to clarify, the end of execute will be like big M underscore value.
So the end of execute, sorry?
Like if we were like writing this in like HCL, so it would be the end of execute would be like the little e big M Python register.
Right? Yes, so this forwarding path, so the question is what does this look like in HCL? So this is eval e probably, and this is d eval b. Okay. So we do this for all our cases. So then we have this subtract to rm move q. So rm move q here, we would write RBX there, and this RM move Q would read it here. So that doesn't work. So we're going to need forwarding, because it's written here and it's read around here, so it's too late when it's naturally written, so we're going to need some sort of forwarding to make that work or to stall. So then we can look again at our restrictions. So the value for RBX is available after near the end of execute. That's the earliest we could possibly forward. If we need to forward before that, we're out of luck. And for RM move Q, we need the value in time for the memory stage. We don't need it during execute because we're not using RBX to compute anything in the execute stage. So we have multiple options in this case for where we forward. We could forward from the end of writeback to the end of execute. We could forward from the end of memory to the end of decode. And if we were really clever, maybe we could forward from the end of execute to the end of fetch. But that seems unlikely. So probably in your processor, you probably implemented either from the end of memory to the end of decode or from the end of writeback to the end of execute. But those are all the possible ways we could forward, and it shows us that forwarding can solve this problem. Yes?
When you said the value for RBX is not ready until the end of execute, you meant execute for the sub instruction, right? Not
yes, execute. So the value of RBX is not ready until the end of the subtract instruction, and it's needed by the memory stage of the RM move Q.
And then my other question was, can you ever forward from the end of a pipeline register, or the end of one stage to the beginning of the stays in the same cycle, but like, so like from the end of memory to the beginning of decode?
So the question is, can we do something like forward from here to the beginning of decode, forward from like here to the beginning of decode, if we needed to do that? So we don't need it in this case, fortunately. So the answer is that HCL would work, but that increases the length of our critical path. So we would not do that. We don't want it to be the case that we have to wait for to complete a cycle for a value like to go get out of the data memory and into another and into like another memory or through all the way through the ALU. That would be too slow. That would defeat the point of pipelining, which is that we want to divide up our work into little pieces. If we have this obscure forwarding path that means that sometimes we have to go through the data memory and the ALU in one cycle, we've lost the advantage of pipelining. So we're never going to do that. Yes?
How are you able to forward from execute to fetch? Like, don't you not have a register with
another step? So, conceptually, it is possible to forward from execute to fetch, but you would need to add things like a register to hold that value, which is why it is very unlikely that you would actually do this. But conceptually, it is possible to do that, right? You need like a whole bunch of special cases. It's like not worth it. So this is like maybe this is a So this is a sort of an unlikely case. I'll probably do that with a. That's probably not going to happen. But it's conceptually possible. You could set up the logic to do that. You need like a whole other special case for the register read. Doesn't really make sense. Yeah.
I have one more question. So is it safe to say that all forwards can end at a decode stage?
No. So the question is it safe to say that all forwards can end at a decode stage? So there is a counterexample. This also might help people on the homework, which is this case. We can't forward from we can't forward that early and still not stall in this case. The value is not available until after the memory stage of the MR move queue. And it's only needed in the memory stage of our move queue. So we better be forwarding after memory and into execute in this case. We just can't do it into the code. So it is not the case, and if you are missing this case in your PyPy homework too, well, maybe you should implement it. Okay, so that was, identifying when we need to forward. Any other questions on those two issues? Yeah. This is not a load use hazard. The load use hazard is so load use hazard is memory to execute only. Memory is solved with forwarding. Only solved with stall plus forwarding. So memory to memory, we can solve with stall plus forwarding. If our pipeline was different, maybe that would not be the case. We've commonly asked questions about what if we have a different pipeline. But because we can figure out a way to forward, we don't need a stall in this case. Yeah?
So when you say it's the load use of memory to execute, you mean the end of memory to the beginning of execution?
That, computed. So this is IO computed in memory to used in execute. So you could call both of these a load use hazard, but the one that we need stalling for with our pipeline design is only the first.
So both of them are hazards, and both of them are hazards where you load a value and immediately use it, but only one of them actually needs a stall. This would be different if we like had two execute stages and needed to wait for both or something like that. That would change how all our hazards work and when we need to do stalling. But we only need, in the case where it works out, that we would have to draw a backwards line instead of this straight line here. Okay. Anything else on these pipelining issues? I'll probably ask for back to that later. So caches, direct map versus associative. So there's a simple way to remember the difference, which is direct map is associative with associativity one. This is exactly what direct map is. And we also briefly talked about fully associative is associative with associativity number of sets. Number of blocks. Everything's in one set, so the associative is the number of blocks. So those are just special cases. So if you know how associative caches work, you know how direct map caches work, you just say it's associativity one. That is one block per set. So tag index offset. How do we actually compute tag index and offset? So the general logic, I think the easiest way to remember it is to think about how the cache is organized. So we have some picture of a cache like this, which you can hopefully sort of remember. And the different parts of the address are things we need for different purposes. So we need the offset bits, which are at the bottom. Say we have a block of data here, in this case a 2-byte block of data, and we need to determine which byte this address refers to. Every address refers to a unique byte. We need to know which one it is. So that's what the offset bits are for. How many do we need? That's just how many bits do we need to say which of the things in the block we need. So if we have two things in a block, we need one bit to say which of the two. If we have four things in a block, we need two bits to say which of the two. So we just need the right number of bits which let us give a unique name to everything that appears in a cache block, every byte. So that's our block offset bits. And those are at the bottom of the address because we store all the block together. When we change the bottom of the address, most frequently that will just change where in the block we are, not which block we're in. Then we have our index bits. Our index bits are next because we want things which aren't in the same block but are next to each other to be in different sets so they don't conflict with each other. We could have put it elsewhere, but that would be silly because it would make our cache a lot worse at exploiting spatial locality. So in this case, we have bits that we use to determine which set we go to. And we want to have each set has a unique sequence of bits that refer to it. So if we have 8 sets, we need 3 bits for each of them to have a unique 3-bit name. So 000, 001, 010, and so on. Those are the bits we use to name each of these sets, which are rows in this picture. And each of them has unique names. So if we have one set, we need 0 bits to determine which one we're referring to. If we have 2, we need 1 bit to determine which of the 2 sets we're referring to. If we have 4, we need 2 bits. And that's how many index bits we're going to have in our address. Yes?
What are lines and sets? Because in the price exam,
you
mentioned lines.
Okay, I will add that to my queue of questions. So That's sets. I'll get to that later.
But also about this, so the middle like tells us which row we're in, but the tag tells us which column we're in, or no? Like which one tells us which way we're in?
So I'll get to the tag next. Okay. So we have, yeah.
What were you saying about putting it somewhere else, or putting like the block somewhere else?
I'm not sure what you're referring to exactly.
I think you were saying that we keep like. You said it'd be like silly because it wouldn't make the cache like less. Like
yeah.
Split this.
Oh, okay. So this is probably about why the index bits are these lower bits next to the offsets. So we wanted to be the case that if we have two adjacent bytes in memory, and they aren't part of the same block, which is going to happen because our blocks aren't infinitely big, that they don't map to the same set. That would be bad. If they map to the same set, then that would mean that you could have two, that means you'd have an array, and you couldn't put it all in a direct map cache, for example, even if it was contiguous and smaller than the cache. We want things that are next to each other in memory to be able to fit in the same cache. So the best thing for spatial locality is that the index bits come right after the offset. We don't want some non-index bits there, because that means that it could be the case that two adjacent blocks in memory map to the same set, which means we're more likely to have conflict misses if our programs have good spatial locality, which is not something which should happen when you have good spatial locality, right? You want less misses. People still look confused. Yeah?
So what's the offset?
The offset is what part of the block we're in. So we have two bytes here, B4 and B5. We want to know which one are we referring to. Are we referring to the B4 byte or the B5 byte? The offset tells us which of those bytes we're referring to.
So why would a contiguous, like an array in memory, why would it go into the same set and then that would...
So we don't want it. So it should be the case if we have this address, if we have the next address, it goes into here, into the next set when we run out of space. This is B5 here. You want, if there's something after it in memory, say B6, we want that to go here in the cache. We don't want it to have to fit it here because then we might have conflict misses.
And that's the same block, but not the same set.
This is not the same. This part is a different set. Because it's a different row. We want the next address to go to a different set.
What about if it's blocks?
So B4 and B5 are in the same block.
Oh, okay.
But the thing after B5, we don't want to be in the same, it can't be in the same block because we've ran out of space in our block, but we don't want it to be in the same set. Because that means that we can't hold adjacent things in the cache very well. Yeah.
Why couldn't we just put it on the other block in the same set?
So the question is, why couldn't we put it in the other block in the same set? So if we were doing that, we could, but we'd eventually. But this means we had less, we're more likely to have conflicts still. And with a direct map cache, we couldn't. So if it was one way associative, we couldn't do that. So our general choice to minimize conflicts is going to be that the index comes right next. So if you have an array, the idea is that if you have an array and you access all of the array contiguously, it's going to fill up the cache exactly if it's the same size. That's what we want, right? If you access exactly the amount of space that fits in the cache with good spatial locality, it should stay in the cache. And if we did some other scheme, that might not happen. So then we have our tag. So our tag is everything else that's left over. So the idea is when we get this B5 here, we need to know, well, was that B5 from this address, or was it from something else? Was there some other thing I stored in the cache that happened to have the same last 4 bits in its address? Because there could have been, and in fact, there is something here. So there's something at 3 with byte 44, and we don't want to give that thing back because that's not the thing that corresponds to this address. That's something from a different address in memory, and the tag bits are what tell us which one is this. So in this case, our tag bits are the remaining bits, whatever's left over, and that's 1, 1 in this case, and that tells us that this first block is the one that corresponds to this address, and the second block corresponds to the address where we have 0, 1 at the beginning and not 1, 1. Yeah.
So the tag bits are basically just saying, where in memory did you get this?
Yes, so the tag bits are all the information about where in memory we got this that we didn't already use to know where it is in the cache.
So if we're like changing memory, we would have to potentially update a lot of tag bits.
So if you had, sorry, you have to add a lot of tag bits if you were...
So had, if you're like writing to memory and whatnot, there. Or is that when you're actually retrieving from memory the tag bits?
The tag bits always come from the address. So they're just the part of the address that we used to get the value into the cache originally. The rest of that address. So they tell us what's there. Whether the value changes or not is orthogonal to that.
So if you're writing to its old memory address, how are you going to update?
So if I'm writing this to memory?
Like if you're writing something else to like wherever, say like 0, 1 was.
Okay. Okay, so if I'm replacing this entry, let's say?
Yeah, but like in memory.
Okay.
And then you try like writing that to the same block.
So the question is what happens when we update memory? How do we keep the cache consistent? So our general policy to keep the cache consistent for this class is that we always talk to the cache and never to memory. So if we want to talk to memory, we have to do it by talking to the cache first. So you won't have that problem. On real systems, they do have this problem because, for example, there are multiple cores. And how you deal with that is a complicated topic, which is like multiple lectures in the grad version of this class called cache coherency. Yeah?
If we think of the sets as rows, can we think of the tags as columns?
The question is, if we think of the sets as rows, can we think of the tags as columns? No, because there's a different tag for each block.
Oh, so wait, are the blocks columns then? Like, what would be the columns in that?
So there's a column, yeah, so you can think of the blocks as columns. So you can think of the blocks as things in a row. The columns, there aren't really, the columns are weights. What we call ways, which is not a term we use very often. But a way is one piece of data and its corresponding valid and tag bits. That's a way of this cache. This is why we say two-way set associative, because there's two ways to put data in. Okay. Question?
So, we said if we're accessing like data that's XT, B4, and B5, we would probably like replace B6. B4 would like B6 or something.
If we're accessing data that's next to B4 and B5, it will probably go here or here, hopefully.
Okay, so let's say we access like B6 or somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, would we replace just B4, not the entire block?
If we're accessing, what address? If we're accessing an address that's not this, that has different index bits, we go to a different set row. So adjacent addresses, because of where we put our index bits, which was correct here, will go to, if we add 1 to this address, it's a different set, so it goes down here. If we subtract 2, it's a different set, so it goes up here.
Okay. Can you go over the quick question after?
I'll add that to...
So the
question is, where does this address coming from? This is the address our processor gave us.
Okay, so that's like where we're saying that this piece of memory or piece of data is.
Yeah, so the processor like is running a load instruction, and that's the address the load instruction loads.
And then we just decide, like, we're going to say it's first part of the tag, third, second part of the index.
Yeah, and as a cache, we need to satisfy that load either by getting from here or by going to memory eventually. Yeah.
Does the cache have a different addressable space than main memory?
So the question is, does the cache have a different addressable space than main memory?
Like,
no. So this address is a normal memory address, and the cache needs to handle any normal memory address. It just can't store everything that fits in memory. So when it's not found, it just says it's not a hit, and it goes to memory. Okay. Yeah.
So could you write, so let's say you write 62111000. Like, could you just replace B4? Like, is that possible?
If I write to, so if I write to, okay, if I write to replace B4, could you just replace B4?
Yeah.
Is that possible? So, that depends. So conceptually, yes, you can just replace B4. How that works, it will depend on our write policy. But yes, you can just replace B4. You probably actually might physically need to rewrite the block to do that, but conceptually we can just replace B4. Yes?
So on the quiz question, when you're asking which is in the same block, just like the 2 bytes in that block.
Yes. So what's in the same block here? So in the same block here. So here, I will, for convenience, switch back to this picture. So let's say we have an address that splits up 11001 into tag, index, offset. So we do that splitting, and we know sizes by number of bytes in a block for offset, number of sets for index, and leftover for tag. That's our summary there. So that we know the sizes by that. Unique bit pattern for each byte, block, byte, set. So we need a unique bit pattern for each byte in the block and a unique bit pattern for each set. And the general idea is that same index, same set. Same index plus tag, same, must be in the same block. We only have one instance of a block in the cache anywhere. Even if we could store multiple copies, we don't want to do that, because that's just wasting space. So that's sort of generally how you're supposed to do the quiz questions. You go through, as you say, is it in the same, you split up the addresses. If they're in the same index, if they have the same index, they go up to the same row, the same set. If they have the same index and the same tag, not only are they going to be in the same row, they have to be this only entry in that row which would have those tag bits, because we're not going to store multiple copies of the same block, of the same data from memory in the cache. Yes?
So how do you know how many blocks you can have in a single set?
So how do we know how many blocks we can have in a single set? This is the associativity. We're going to have to be told that, or somehow figure out from other things in the question how that could be. Like, if we tell you how many sets there are and how many blocks, how big a block is and how big the cache is, you could figure out how many set blocks there must be for a set.
So if we have a four-way set, and in one set we only have 4 blocks, right?
Yeah, that's what that means, yes.
For the quiz in particular, we had a block size of 6 and a set size of 13 bits, which are not exactly the nicest numbers to play with, so I end up having to convert the entire number to binary.
Yes, so on a,
for the exam.
On an exam, we will try to make numbers simpler, but on a quiz, we felt that like you had calculators, right.
It
things like that.
Before the exam, hopefully, it'll be a little nicer.
Okay, back there?
So there could be other bytes in the same block that don't have the same tag, right?
There could be other bytes in the same block. No, so the block has one tag. If you look at our picture, there's one tag for each of those 2 blocks. So each of those two, there's 2 tags there, one for the first block, one for the second block. Everything, they better come from the same part of memory, the 2 bytes in the block, or else we're in trouble. Yeah.
Are they just used to separate between something in a set? Like, is there a reason why there's two bytes for these tags, whereas when there's only two ways that it should be? Like, you really only use one byte, right?
There's two bits for the tag. There's two bits because there are only two things we could store, but it's possible to have, like, we could have 0, 0 and 1, 0 as the tags. That would mean that our blocks are from a different part of memory. So let's say instead of having the tag 1, 1 there, we had the tag 0, 0. That would mean that B4B5 was not from this address, but from the address 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1.
So it's just about where it is in the actual
memory. Where it is in the actual memory, yes. And we need all the bits because our cache can potentially store a value from anywhere in memory. So we need all to use all the bits in the address somewhere.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
How many ways is that cache?
So this is a two-way set associative cache. There are two ways because there's two blocks per set.
But why do we have two tags? Wouldn't that be more?
The number of tag bits is just how much we have left over in the address. If I had bigger memory addresses, I'd need more tag bits. If I had smaller memory addresses, I'd need less tag bits. Okay. So I think that includes the quiz question strategy.
A quick question.
Yeah.
For the was it the address we're using to break up the tag index offset? Is that technically in hexadecimal, or that happens to be all ones and zeros?
The address I was showing you was. This is binary, and you can tell it's binary because there is one offset bit, and not 16, given how much we're storing.
So I guess the only question is, since the data itself is, B4, assume that that's hexadecimal.
Yeah, so that's hexadecimal, yes. So there's mix of binary and hexadecimal on the slide. I apologize for the confusion there. But it's just to keep things kind of uncluttered. Okay. So next question, topics, I'll try to... So any more questions on tag index offset? Yeah.
Just the definition of the term line.
Line? Oh, we'll get to that later. It's on my list. Yes. Back there? No? Okay. So parallel versus serial. So in this cache access, one of the things we have to do is we have to compare the tag to the value stored for, the value we get from the set, and say, do we actually have a copy of this address? So in this case, we see the tag 1, 1 matches the tag in the address, and that means, yes, there's a copy, and it's in fact the first block and not the second one. So that comparison we can do without looking at the data. So we have two options. So the serial option is check tag for match before looking at data. And this parallel option is check tag for match while fetching data. And these are equivalent as far as what the answer is, but this is faster but uses more power. It's faster because we start the data lookup earlier. This is slower but uses less power, so because there's no lookup on a miss. Yeah.
Serial in L2.
So the question is, why did Sierra say we would use the parallel option in L1 and serial in L2 or L3? So saving power for the L2 and L3 is more of an advantage versus the speed difference. So the tag lookup is faster than the data lookup typically. And we don't care about a little bit of extra latency for the L2 and L3 as much. Versus where the L1, we really, really care about latency. It's really bad if we can't make the L1 access take about one cycle. Because if it takes like 5 cycles instead of 3, then we have 3 memory stages instead of 5, and you have all these extra cases where you need to stall. But the speed of the L2 and L3 don't come up as often. So for those, it's less important to have the lowest possible latency. And you can afford to make compromises to give better power consumption. There also might be other issues about multiple cache accesses at the same time, which we won't talk about in this class, that affect that decision. But there's other factors and about how what the L2 and L3 caches are used for. Yes?
For the parallel option, if you had like an associative like set or like associative like cache, then would you have to like fetch all the blocks in that set?
So the question is, for the parallel option, do I need to fetch all the blocks in that set? So yeah. Okay. With the serial option maybe you could avoid that. And that's another reason we might save power. Whether or not you would depends on your cache design, but yeah, you can actually avoid that in the serial case if you want to. Yeah.
So essentially in parallel option, your wait, like if you were to wait for the data fetching, you would eliminate a lot of the like things you need to check. Is that why you use more power?
Which one?
So in parallel, because you are not waiting for the data, you end up checking a lot of extra stuff.
You end up spending the power to read the data, even if all the data in the cache is not the memory address you're looking for.
And how would you know if that's the case?
Because you check the tag eventually. Okay. So you read the data, and if the tags don't match, you just throw away that data you read. Okay. In the serial option, we don't do that. We don't read it in the first place if we don't need it.
Is the tag bit like stored in the tag store and the depth and the data?
Yes. Like, so on this picture, the green stuff is the tag store. The blue stuff is the data store.
So in the parallel option, you would fetch the data and then you check the tag like alongside the fetching.
So in the parallel option, you'd fetch the entire thing in red,
yeah. And
then check the tag and do all this logic. In the serial option, you'd only fetch the stuff in green, and only if the hit signal is 1 would you fetch the stuff in blue. Okay. So write back versus write through. So write through is always send writes to memory immediately. Write back is send writes to memory when you'd forget otherwise about value otherwise. So, i.e. on replacement. Yeah.
So this has to do with the parallel and serial thing again. So Sumiro had a equation for the latency,
mm-hmm. And
by looking at it, it seems like that's only the parallel. No, that's only the serial option. So I guess time would equal the time to access the cache plus probability of miss times the time to access the next level. So that would be a serial option.
Okay, so this is parallel versus serial cache accesses to a single cache. So we should talk separately about multiple levels of cache. So cache in memory. So the policy is access level 1. If that fails, then access level 2. Always serially. So we always do this serially because we don't want to just send we would not get much advantage if we sent a whole bunch of memory accesses to main memory all the time, even if they all hit cache. So this is generally something we will always do serially.
Why wouldn't you access the parallel?
So there's only so many accesses that the slower caches can handle at a time. Like, we'll end up waiting if we try to do it in parallel. So you could do a bit of this. So yeah, so I guess I'd say almost always serially. They just don't have the capacity that the level 2 cache, it might take 10 times as long to do an access. Like, it just, so it doesn't save much time to do it in parallel. And they probably can't handle that many accesses. Like level one cache, you want to do one access every cycle, let's say. Probably you can't do that on the level two cache. It can't handle that many accesses that fast. Like you can only maybe handle three at a time and they take 10 times as long. So you can only like do three every 10 cycles. So you can't keep, they can't keep up anyways. So generally it's gonna be the case that we do that as far as accessing levels, it's always serial. Conceptually, maybe you could optimize this and we might in a more advanced class talk about that, but usually not. Yeah.
So like in our processor, when we're talking about the latency for the memory stage, is that a latency for the entire for all the memory or just for the L1 cache?
So the question is, caches in our processor. So latency for memory stage is basically stages if cache hit. If cache miss, pipeline processor will stall. That's typically the pipeline processor implementation. The latency we see for the memory stage is the cache hit latency. And if there's a cache miss, we're going to stall because the memory is going to be slower. And we're going to have sort of that wait for done signal like I showed earlier. Signal. Okay. Back versus write through. So this is what our cache does on a write. So there's two options. One is we always send the write. We just always forward the write to the real memory, or the next level of cache at least. Immediately, and the write back option is we only send it when we need to. That only when we would otherwise forget about the value, because we don't want to lose a write, but if as long as we have a copy of the value we're writing, we should be okay. So in the write back policy, we need extra state, we need a dirty bit, which is do we need to write this eventually? So if we don't have that, then every time we are evicted something from our cache, we need to write it to memory, which is not very good. It's a lot of extra traffic to memory that will slow down our system. So in this case, we keep track of, is this value not the same as memory? And if it is, and we replace it, as part of replacing it, we don't just remove the value from the cache, but we also send it to memory. Yes?
So that means that for our cache, each block has now an additional bit that we're designated as a dirty bit.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And whether or not we have written that value to RAM yet.
Yeah. Whether, yeah. And need to. And yeah, and we definitely need to write it at least when we replace the block in the cache. Yeah.
Would the dirty bit be in the tag part?
Yes. So it would be in the tag store. Because it's going to be part of our replacement decision.
It's like where in the line would it be? Would it be the beginning of the tag?
Or? So conceptually, you can think of it being as another column next to the valid column.
So it's not part of the memory address?
It's not part of the memory address. Yeah, it's like the valid column. It's unrelated to the memory address. It's information about the block. Yeah. Can we use the AMAP formula?
Yeah, it's like.
I will add that to this list later. Okay, so that's write back versus write through. I'll get to that in a second. So DRAM versus SRAM. So DRAM is denser and slower. SRAM is less dense and faster. Denser meaning more bytes per size, and cheaper, I should say. So this is what caches are made of, usually. This is a memory, usually. So main memory. You could use either for both, but this is typically what happens. Okay. Tech trends, CPUs going faster than memory. We didn't cover this. I will gladly talk about it.
With DRAM and SRAM, what about power consumption?
It's complicated. Yeah.
DRAM and SRAM about them, like volatility and maintaining their values over time.
Yes, and we will not ask about that on the exam. I'd like to get to more topics, so I'm not going to cover that right now unless we find more time. Okay, so lines versus sets. So our book makes the distinction that a line is a block plus block plus metadata. Other sources might sometimes say line equals block, exactly. Set has multiple blocks or lines. Lines, if set associative. Gosh. So line's different than set. Some sources use it interchangeably with block. Sometimes there's a little bit of a distinction. We will be careful about not using the term when it's ambiguous. Block and line and block, but it's not the same thing as a set.
If we didn't cover it, we won't be expected to know what that, right?
Yeah. Okay. If we use it, it means block. Yeah, just it's important to know that line is not a set, because a set can contain multiple blocks, aka multiple lines. Okay, AMATs. So the formula is hit latency times hit time. Or sorry, times hit rate plus miss latency times miss rate. And the reason why this formula is interesting is different optimizations improve different parts. So like there are things we can do, like increasing the size of the cache will increase the hit latency and increase the hit rate and therefore decrease the miss rate. So you need to actually know the numbers to figure out which effect that will have on your overall metric, which is this average memory access time. This is overall cache performance metric. So this is a way, when designing a cache, how we evaluate how good our design is. Yeah?
I like the slide didn't help it, because like if you're missing, you still have to like check.
So this is also equal to hit latency plus miss penalty times miss rate. So miss penalty miss latency minus hit latency is the extra time for a miss. So there's two versions of the formula. Miss latency is the total time for a miss. Miss penalty is the additional time for a miss. And you can use either one. They're equivalent. Because our accesses to multiple levels of cache are almost always serial. Okay. And yeah, let's not delete that line. Okay. Okay, so I'll get back to tech trends if we have time. But first, so cache blocking. So we're not going to ask you like whether one blocking is better than another or anything like that, because that's something you actually have to like run the code to figure out. But we do expect you to know, spatial versus, does a loop have temporal locality? Access something repeatedly. Loop have spatial locality. Access nearly adjacent things consecutively. So you should be able to identify when that happens and whether one thing is better than the other in one of these respects. Yeah.
So in this case, when you're talking, I remember the book talking about how there's a general relation between the number of the size of your stride versus how much spatial locality you have. Mm-hmm. That sort of seems like a gray area of what you consider to be good spatial locality?
We will be careful in the exam to ask questions which are unambiguous, like we will ask which one of these has better locality or something like that, where you should be able to figure it out regardless of whether it's good or bad. Yeah.
In terms of performance, we're not going to be expected to do something like we did in class on last Thursday, where we did a for loop and fired it up, or.
So we would expect you to be able to identify that such a thing like might has better spatial locality or worse. We expect you to be able to figure that part out if we showed you it. We won't expect you to synthesize that on a test. There will be an assignment for which doing that may be helpful after the exam. But on the exam, what we expect you to know is if you look at some loops, is the locality better or worse in some particular way? You should be able to figure that out. And you should know the general concept of cache blocking about that it's improving some form of locality. Okay, so precise exceptions and reorder buffers. Okay, so let's see if I can quickly insert, draw this. Okay, So precise exceptions, that issue is we might, we might do something like, arm remove q sub q XOR Q. So we might do something like this. And we'd like it to really be the case that let's say this produces an exception. Let's say this seg faults. Okay. In that case, we'd really like it to be the case that when we debug that seg fault, that cx rdx I. So that when we debug this seg fault, that when we look at, so let's say we take out our out of order processor might have executed this instruction and this instruction and this instruction and not this instruction yet. And then this instruction seg faulted. When we debug this, we went to look at our, open up GDB and we type info registers. And we want it to be the case that RCX is not that value. Right, we don't want to see that it's seg faulted and RCX has a value that doesn't make any sense. So precise exceptions are that this is an exception, the seg fault. And the precise exception idea is that the add sub XOR appear not have run. So it looks like when that seg fault happens and we examine what's the state of all the registers in our debugger, that the add, the subtract, and the XOR didn't happen. Yeah?
Wouldn't none of those actually run because they rely off of RCX, which is.
Sorry, this my handwriting is horrible. So those are all independent instructions. So our out-of-order processor could run all these other instructions that don't use RAX while that load is happening. So that load triggers a seg fault. We would like it to be the case that the add, the subtract, and the XOR don't run. That's the idea of precise exceptions. Yeah? Yeah, so that means it's really hard to debug what happened here. So I break out my debugger, and maybe the value of RAX is right, maybe even not. Like, it could actually not be right. So, like, you break out of a debugger, and let's say that's writes to REX. Break out of the debugger, the value of REX is even wrong, isn't an address which triggers a seg fault, and all the values are wrong. It's really hard to figure out what's going on. It's not impossible, necessarily, but it's really hard to figure out what's going on. So as a processor designer, we don't want that to happen. And reorder buffers are implementation mechanism. So basically, in the reorder buffer, we're going to have an entry for MR move queue, and for add queue, and XOR queue, and sub queue, and XOR queue. And we're going to store the result of the instruction. So like, say, so we'll store what the outcome of each of these instructions are in the reorder buffer before we let them be visible, like, to our debugger. In this way, when we figure out that MR move Q doesn't work, we can just throw away these entries that we already computed. Yeah.
The bot goes in GDB to actually look at this, or is it just gone?
Look at what?
The order buffer.
No, the state is not visible to any user program on pretty much any modern processor ever. Like, this throwing away happens before even the operating system gets to do anything. There have been processors which expose that, but not ours. Okay. And I'm basically out of time. I will continue to answer questions, but I have a feeling there's another class in here at some point. So, don't think that that's going to make sense.